Welcome to this week's edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of the news from the grassroots. News overlooked by the corporate media. The show airs every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on WRCT 88.3 FM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and every Saturday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WVJW Benwood 94.1 FM in the Wheeling, West Virginia area. We're also available on the internet, both on WRCT's live web stream at WRCT.org and archived at radio.indypgh.org.
On today's show, on the second anniversary of the start of the war in Iraq, anti-war demonstrators take to the streets in Pittsburgh and around the world, Norman Finkelstein and his talk at Carnegie Mellon, and an interview with this week's featured local grassroots organization, Prevention Point Pittsburgh. But first, these headlines. Rust Belt Radio would like to wish local activist Stephen Donahue a happy 50th birthday.
Starting early Friday evening, peace activists gathered in Squirrel Hill for an all-night silent vigil to honor the victims of the Iraq War. The event organizers estimate that more than 100 people participated throughout the night. Rust Belt talked to some participants about what they were doing and why.
We're putting a bag into that bag.
Huh?
We're putting a bag of sand into that bag.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And this is tonight a peace vigil, a silent vigil that begins at 6, and it's going to be all night, and ending tomorrow around 2 o'clock.
An all-night thing shouldn't be too bad because I feel really sorry for all the people in Iraq, and I think we're all victims of the war, so...
Well, there'll be some people coming by and talking. Most of them will be friendly.
And we're a bully in the neighborhood. It's a global village now, and we should be, like Mr. Rogers says, we should be a good neighbor. And we don't support this.
To me, it should be a signal that we're not as welcome there as perhaps we would like to, or some people would like to feel that we are.
Bring the troops home, because with some countries gradually starting to pull out, even though Bush isn't quite getting the message yet, somehow I think, like my grandmother used to say, gotta slap some sense into that boy.
People over there dying, it could have just as easily, except for a turn of fate, been my own children or people in my family. And for what? You know, I mean, they haven't made the world a better place by their dying. And it's very, very sad.
Sure, this isn't going to be the first. There will be many, many of these taking place until some kind of resolve takes place where soldiers are able to come home.
As long as you're working for peace, as long as you're expressing love, you can't lose.
Stay tuned to Rust Belt Radio for more coverage of the weekend's anti-war protest later in the show.
On Friday, March 18th, Pennsylvania Cleanways and the Urban Ecology Collaborative sponsored an environmental forum known as Merge 2. The forum highlighted grassroots organizations. Marna Taylor spoke on behalf of the Wilkinsburg Clean and Green, a group dedicated to increasing environmental awareness and community pride in Wilkinsburg. And Lucia Noel spoke about the Freeride Recycle Bicycle Cooperative, and the connections between bicycles, sustainability, and self-empowerment. Diane Swan spoke about the Rosedale Block Cluster, a South Homewood group that trains youth in horticulture. In addition to these speakers at the event brought together many grassroots groups that discussed potential ways to help make Pittsburgh more environmentally friendly.
For more on all of our local news stories, visit pittsburgh.indymedia.org.
And you're listening to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of the news overlooked by the corporate media. We turn now to headlines from independent media centers around the world.
On Friday, President Bush announced the appointment of Kevin Martin to head the Federal Communications Commission. He will replace Michael Powell as the chairman of the organization. Powell is leaving after 7.5 years on the commission, including 4 years as chairman. Kevin Martin was appointed to the FCC in 2001. Martin is considered an advocate of reducing government's regulation of telecommunication companies and increasing the monitoring and enforcement of so-called indecent content on the airwaves. He pleased Christian conservative groups when he dissented from an FCC decision not to fine the NBC television network for singer Bono's use of an expletive during the 2003 Golden Globe Awards ceremony. He has also been in favor of stiffer penalties against media companies that broadcast indecent material. Previous to Kevin Martin's FCC job, he served on the Bush-Cheney transition team and was general counsel for Bush's 2000 presidential campaign. His wife, Kathy Martin, is a former aide to Vice President Dick Cheney. Now she works in the White House as a special assistant to the president for economic policy. Thank you to Democracy Now! For that report.
On Tuesday, March 8th, the government of Guatemala began the process of ratifying the U.S. Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. Guatemalan popular organizations managed to delay a vote with large protests. The organizations, which included farmers, indigenous communities, students, and teachers, say CAFTA will destroy their livelihood. They took to the streets again last week to prevent the Congress from voting in favor of the business interests there. And this time, police responded with force. According to reports from Guatemalan organizations and Amnesty International, after CAFTA was ratified by the Guatemalan Congress on March 14th, tens of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets. Police used tear gas and a water cannon to disperse them. 19 people were injured and 16 were detained. And on the next day, Guatemalan army forces fired on protesters in the western city of Huehuetenango, killing two people, Juan Lopez and Jose Sanchez Gomez, injuring many more. The civil society organizations representing the protesters have called for additional demonstrations throughout the country. Many fear that the government will engage in more violence to repress the popular rejection of CAFTA. The Guatemalan popular movement is calling for international solidarity to denounce these actions and pressure the government for an end to violence. In addition to violence against protesters, Amnesty International issued an urgent action appeal on Friday on behalf of journalists in Guatemala that have received death threats for reporting on the anti-CAFTA demonstrations. The threats and intimidation directed toward journalists Marielos Monzon and Gabriel Mazarovich are part of what appears to be an effort to force them to stop reporting on the demonstrations.
Lifting the veil on one of the least advertised and least edifying scandals of the Second World War, the U.S. government has settled a complaint that American Army officers requisitioned an entire train loaded with valuables seized by the Nazis from Jewish families in Hungary and then kept much of the contents for themselves. The U.S. Justice Department confirmed that it will pay $25.5 million to the Hungarian Jewish community in America to make up for the confiscation of the contents of what has been dubbed the Gold Train. The train left Hungary on March 30, 1945, and as the war ended, it was seized by the U.S. Army. The sum may represent only a fraction of the true value of the contents of the train, which consisted of 29 boxcars crammed with treasures surrendered to Nazis by hundreds of Hungarian Jews, many of whom died in concentration camps before the war's end. When the Americans took control of the train and agreed that they would arrange for the return of the contents to the families, many of whom had receipts provided by the Nazis. That, however, is not what happened. According to the complaint filed in the lawsuit, U.S. Army officers not only failed to secure the goods, most of which went into a warehouse in Salzburg, Austria, but then turned a blind eye when U.S. soldiers made off with many of the items. It was also alleged that the U.S. government auctioned off remaining treasures in New York in 1947 to help pay the cost of refugees at the end of the war, thanks to the Asheville Global Report for that story.
Last week, George W. Bush announced his nomination for the next president of the World Bank, and his nomination was the current U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz. Wolfowitz is most notable for his role as chief architect of the 2003 invasion of Iraq and is seen as an extremely hawkish neoconservative ideologue. Former chief economist of the World Bank, Joseph Stiglitz, has launched an attack on the U.S. plans to appoint Wolfowitz. Stiglitz is a Nobel laureate and one of the world's most influential economists, author of the book Globalization and Its Discontents. Stiglitz said, quote, "The World Bank will once again become a hate figure. This could bring street protests and violence across the developing world." The mission of the World Bank is to, quote, "fight poverty and improve the living standards of people in the developing world." However, the World Bank has been criticized for doing just the opposite, from causing environmental damage in the developing world to doing more harm than good to struggling economies when pushing for privatization. The process for selecting a World Bank president has also drawn fierce criticism from the business community. Traditionally, the president of the World Bank has been nominated by the U.S. president, a process the Financial Times of London called a politicized insider's game. Across Europe, as well as across the developing world where the bank's policies are most felt, opposition to the nomination of Wolfowitz has been widespread and vocal. The Congress of South African Trade Unions said that it was shocked at the nomination of, quote, "such a conservative into a position which ought to be advancing the interests of the poor," end quote. However, African nations have very little say in the matter. This is despite the fact that the World Bank directly affects the African continent more than any other.
You can read more about our global news stories by visiting indymedia.org.
And we'll be back after a brief break.
This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of March 17th, 2005.
I police!
Bad Cop No Donut!
Bad.
Cop.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. A police officer in Fairchance, Pennsylvania, has been suspended without pay indefinitely this week in connection to a beating outside of a Uniontown bar. According to WNEP, the officer, Ken Bittinger, was arrested the week before and charged with aggravated assault, simple assault, harassment, and disorderly conduct. A police officer in Rodell, West Virginia, has been arrested on charges of domestic battery and brandishing a weapon. The Associated Press says that Officer Daniel Ray Price has already been released on a $100,000 bond. According to police, Price was arrested based on complaints made last month, including an incident which took place at a local hospital while the officer was in uniform. If convicted, Price faces 2 years behind bars and $1,500 in fines.
And that was Ron Anisich from CKLN Toronto with our weekly update on police brutality and misconduct. And that was his reports from our area, including Fayette County and West Virginia. So welcome back to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of the news overlooked by the corporate media.
On Monday, March 14, 2005, Norman Finkelstein spoke at CMU as part of the Palestine Awareness Series. Finkelstein is the renowned author of The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering, Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. His talk was entitled Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history, which is also the title of his new book. The lecture was pushed back a month on the request of members of the Hillel Jewish University Center, who argued that too many speakers who opposed Israeli policies have been coming to the university in too short a time. During the same time, Tartans for Israel and Hillel have organized many events in support of Israel, including bringing someone from the Israeli Defense Forces. During the month that the talk was postponed, Hillel asked the, quote, Pittsburgh Jewish community to quietly fill the lecture hall with those who cannot be influenced by Finkelstein's rhetoric because, quote, through filling the hall with Jewish students and community, we will minimize participation of those who can be influenced by his propaganda, end quote. CMU also allowed for a 10-minute talk by Professor Mitchell Small to appease the protesters. Previous to his speech, Rust Belt reporter Mitchell Culkern had the opportunity to interview Norman Finkelstein. We will now listen to excerpts of that interview, especially in reference to his book, The Holocaust Industry.
You say that the post-67 war, there was more public support in the United States for Israel, mm-hmm. and in the process, have, you say, kind of co-opted the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Could you speak on that?
Well, after the June 67 war, two fundamental things change. Number one, Israel becomes the U.S.'s strategic asset in the Middle East. Up until June 67, the U.S. relationship was very ambivalent to Israel. Sometimes supportive, sometimes less supportive during the Eisenhower years. Less supportive, Truman years, not much either way. More supportive during the Kennedy years. But there's a kind of ambivalence. Israel hasn't yet proven itself to be a vital interest for the U.S. After June 67, Israel smashes the Arab armies and humiliates the third, defeats and humiliates the third world hordes, and now becomes a crucial ally of the U.S. They're standing at the front lines of Judeo-Christian civilization, beating back the third world Arab hordes, and successfully, unlike, say, the U.S. and Vietnam at the time. And so now Israel becomes a strategic asset, and it becomes safe to be pro-Israel. In fact, when you're pro-Israel, you're now super pro-American, because the Israel little Israel is defending our interests in the Middle East. And up until 67, it wasn't so safe to be pro-Israel in the United States. First of all, I said the relationship between the U.S. and Israel was ambivalent. And also, Israel seemed, on the surface at any rate, to be kind of leftist. They were avowedly socialist. They had all these communistic experiments like the kibbutzim. The leading party, the Mapai, was technically a member of the Socialist International. The leading dissenting party, called the Mapam, was totally pro-Soviet. And so American Jews, you know, they don't want to hear about a communist Jewish state or a socialist Jewish state. Remember, it's the Cold War. After 67, it's clear Israel is now safely in our corner. And so American Jews begin to identify with Israel. It's safe. And in fact, it brings nice dividends. You get now to be important because you're acting as the interlocutor between Israel and the United States government because you're an American Jew. At that point, they discover the Nazi Holocaust. I don't think they really actually discovered the historical event, the Holocaust. What they discovered was a historical event which now could be molded to serve certain ideological purposes. And the main ideological purpose it served was pretty straightforward. The Nazi Holocaust henceforth was characterized as this unique case of suffering in the history of humanity. No suffering could compare to the suffering of the Jews. And therefore, if the suffering of Jews was unique, then it was unfair to apply normal or conventional moral standards to Jews. Because whenever you want to raise the issue, oh, Israel's occupying Arab land, Israel's practicing torture, Israel's blowing up houses, the standard response was, but what about the Holocaust? And doesn't that give us special dispensations? And that was the basic purpose it served. And the other purpose it basically served was the Nazi Holocaust was conceived of as the culmination of Gentile hatred of the Jews, and that all the Gentiles, non-Jews, all the Gentiles and non-Jews, they all want to kill the Jews. Lurking in the heart of every Gentile is this homicidal anti-Semitism. It means, number one, that we have the right to do whatever we want in the name of self-defense. Since they all want to kill us, then obviously, in the name of self-defense, you're allowed to do anything. And second of all, since everyone out there is a latent or blatant anti-Semite, it follows that none of their criticism has any validity because it's not motivated by rational criteria of right and wrong, human rights reports. No, it's all the impetus behind all Gentile criticism of the Jews is anti-Semitism.
Finkelstein spoke about his search for truth and his research uncovering, quote, faulty scholarship. He quoted Benny Morris, Israeli historian and author of Righteous Victims, A History of the Zionist Arab Conflict, about Morris's thoughts on ethnic cleansing.
Let me begin with the legitimate differences on the Israel-Palestine conflict, those about which honest people can disagree. So let's take the question which I mentioned earlier, the refugee question. You can agree that what happened in 1948 was an ethnic cleansing. That's a factual question. It's a historical question. However, you can reach altogether different moral conclusions about the historical question. You can agree on the history, but that doesn't mean you reach the same moral conclusion about it. Concretely, what does that mean? Let's take the historian I mentioned earlier, Benny Morris, the Israeli historian. He's done more than any single scholar to shed light on what happened to the refugees in 1948. He says, yes, it was what he calls a partial ethnic cleansing, because 130,000 Palestinians were not expelled in 1948. He says, yes, it was a
partial ethnic cleansing. It wasn't ethnic cleansing. But he says, I think it was a good thing. I think it was good that the Palestinians were expelled in 1948. He said, just as it was good, and I'm using his words now, not mine, just as it was good that the native population was native population of North America was annihilated, his words, just as it was good that the North American population was annihilated because it made way for the great American Republic, he said it was a good thing that the Palestinians were expelled in 48 because it made way for a Jewish state, and a Jewish state is a good. And he goes on to say that, in my view, the one mistake that was made in 1948 was that David Ben-Gurion, who was the leader of the Zionist movement back then, later the first prime minister of the state of Israel, he says, in my view, the big mistake that David Ben-Gurion made in 1948 was that he didn't expel all the Arabs between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. He should have expelled all those who eventually became Israeli Palestinians. He should have expelled all the Arabs from Gaza, and he should have expelled all the Arabs from the West Bank. Had he done so, said Morris, we wouldn't have all the problems that we have today. So he doesn't disagree on the facts, but he reaches an unconventional, one can say, I think, fairly, a Nazi moral conclusion that ethnic cleansing is a good thing.
Finkelstein likened Palestinians' resistance to the Israeli occupation to Native Americans' resistance to European colonists.
Let's take one which is close to home. Let's take the case of the Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment in North America. Now, we don't have to be so politically correct as to gainsay, as to deny, that that resistance was very bloody. Native Americans, they killed men, women, children, civilians. It was a very bloody, ugly resistance. Not to say it wasn't also bloody and ugly on the other side, as the Euro-American settlers acted like beasts and savages, just as those who they were attacking in reaction act like beasts and savages. That's the historical record. But what would one think, of a historian who made the claim that the impetus, the motivation behind Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment, that they made the argument it was all due to anti-Europeanism or anti-Christianism or anti-whiteism? Well, people would react as many of you are now reacting in the audience. It's ridiculous. It's simply trying to confuse and obscure a very uncomplicated reality. Native Americans reacted as they did for the same reason that many years later, though not so many years later, Arabs in Palestine reacted as they did, namely, Benny Morris's expression, the fear of territorial dispossession and displacement. And as it happens, in both cases, that fear turned out to be very rational, because in both cases, that's exactly what eventually happened. Where the indigenous population was dispossessed and displaced.
If you would like to hear all of Finkelstein's speech, you can go to the Pittsburgh Indie Media site at www.indypgh.org.
More than 750 communities around the world held protests this weekend to march the second anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War. In Pittsburgh, almost 3,000 protesters marched from Squirrel Hill to the University of Pittsburgh's William Pitt Union in Oakland.
I'm Jody Lincoln. I'm from Pittsburgh. Squirrel Hill.
And what brings you out to this protest here today?
War's not the answer. Killing people doesn't solve anything. We need peace. The answer is civilized, not going off and killing everybody for the wrong reasons.
Did you bring your parents with you today?
Yep. They didn't bring me. I brought them.
Old and young, Christian pacifists and anti-authoritarian anarchists, they came. On Saturday, March 19th, between 2,000 and 3,000 protesters gathered in Pittsburgh to mark the second anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War. They marched 2 miles from the Squirrel Hill neighborhood to the University of Pittsburgh, chanting, drumming, and singing their opposition to a war that has cost 1,500 American lives and more than 100,000 Iraqi civilian lives.
Immoral, racist, and empire-building war with all the democratic means at our disposal. Let's be clear. Let's be clear. George Bush, our DWR president, that's driving while ignorant. He's declared war on innocent civilians and children in Iraq and needlessly put our young men and women soldiers in harm's way. But let's be clear, because this is intrinsic into us winning this battle. George Bush has also declared war on American cities, on American small towns, working families, seniors, and young people in particular.
Well, in terms of numbers, this is definitely the largest protest we've had here in Pittsburgh since the war began. We're looking at close to 2,000 people who are here in the streets marching. I think it's really important to note that we have people today who are marching with us who initially supported this war. And after 2 years, we've looked back and they realize they've been betrayed and deceived by the Bush administration. There are no weapons of mass destruction. This is not a quick action. We're talking long-term occupation, lives of American soldiers at 1,500 going. And I think we have to realize that it's not what they initially bargained for.
What do we want?
Peace!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Peace!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Peace!
When do we want it?
Now!
Hi, I'm Laura.
I'm Lauren.
And what brought you out here today?
Necessity. It's time for the American troops to be taken out of Iraq. I really like that it's a community thing. Out to get it. Know that you're not alone in your views.
I'm George Edwards from Wilkinsburg.
And
I'm a retired labor leader in the steelworkers. And I think that besides all the killing, both sides, and particularly the Iraqis, this has taken away all the tax dollars that should be put into things like Social Security, health care, and all the other benefits that are being taken away.
How many peace protests have you been to?
I started about 50 years ago in the Korean War. I've been marching ever since.
Thanks.
My name is Jim Leahy. I'm from Pittsburgh.
And what brings you out here today?
I'm fed up with the war, but that I see as a very small part of the larger picture. It's basically people valuing, trying to support a global economy at the cost of everybody that we don't care about's lives. That's basically it. It's basically a question of dollars over lives.
This, along with the coffin up ahead, our coffins to represent the dead in Iraq and the dead American soldiers and the hundreds of thousands of dead Iraqi civilians.
You want to tell me what this tell me about what you're walking in.
What
What's the question, please?
Don't you want
We're walking in the love tank. It's really heavy. Gotta keep moving, sorry, man.
We don't want your war! We don't want your peace!
Do you want to tell me about this project?
Sure. Basically, it started out as it was going to be a tank, but it's changed formed a little bit. Now, it's a big giant box. And it was a real struggle to get in here, but we made it. And hopefully a lot of people see it. One side is things that you do not like, and the other side is things that you support. And basically the things, you know, the bad things are everything from, like, xenophobia to George Bush to, like, all over the map.
No, the second one down.
What's your name and where are you from?
I'm Robert Farrell. I'm from Floyd Park University.
Okay. And what brought you out here today?
Brought me out here today? I never made it to a protest against the war before. I wanted to make it to the inauguration. Couldn't make it for that. This felt like the right thing to do.
Sister Jeanette Busson.
And where are you from?
I'm from Baden, Sisters of St. Joseph. Yeah. Okay. Just up the road. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And what brings you to this demonstration?
Well, because I feel strongly about that no problem can ever be solved by violence and war. And it hurts not only the young men and women and older men and women who are fighting and being killed, but also it hurts everybody involved, the whole country and the world, especially the world. Well, I think that the morals go much deeper than issues of stem cell research or abortion. The issues that we need to be concerned about are issues of poverty and violence and war, and we need to learn how to solve our problems, not by by continued war, but by learning how to be with one another. There has never been a problem solved by violence and war.
Diane Santarello, mother of a soldier who was killed by an improvised explosive device, was among the speakers at the rally following the march.
You may notice that I wear a gold star pin as a symbol of the sacrifice our family suffered. I also wear a yellow ribbon to demonstrate support for our troops. I had a yellow ribbon pin on when the Army came to my door at 8:30 in the morning on August 14th to tell our family that our lives would hold an emptiness forever. When one questions this war, one is accused of not supporting the troops. What does supporting the troops mean? The Bush administration, yes, bring them home. The Bush administration fails to support the troops. He failed to plan for the insurgency. Body armor was issued to the troops in combat positions. It became apparent that snipers and suicide bombers were targeting all of our troops. On May 15, 2003, General Cody ordered the budget office to buy all of the bulletproof vests it could. He would give one to every soldier regardless of position. The Army gave these vests the same priority as they did in issuing additional socks. Coalition forces took 12 days to get body armor to their troops. They bought the armor from a contractor here in the United States. Some parents managed to get body armor and mail them to their children. Our Army took 167 days to get their armor there. That is supporting the troops. My son was killed by an IED. There are IED detectors in Iraq guarding the oil fields, but very few helping to protect our troops. According to Representative Gene Taylor of Mississippi, there is the technology to prevent the detonation of most improvised devices that exist. We've allocated money for it, and yet the number remains classified. Mr. Secretary, not because the insurgents don't know how few are protected, but because I'm of the opinion that the American people would be appalled if they knew how few troops were protected. We all know about the Humvees that lack armor. Some soldiers speaking out about delays in armor were punished. Bush does not support our wounded. The waiting time for the wounded to receive benefits is inexcusable. He limits the time that one can claim post-traumatic stress disorder in spite of the medical evidence that shows it may take a long time for it to manifest itself. They accuse us of not supporting the troops so the public cannot see that they have failed their jobs. Smoke and mirrors. Wearing a yellow ribbon, having a yellow magnetic ribbon on your car is not supporting the troops.
Diane Santarello's daughter, Amy, also spoke.
I'll also remember the last bit of knowledge that I was able to share with my brother. On August 4th, 2003, after traveling for 26 hours by car to see my brother, for at that time I didn't know would be the last, he came home to his home after a briefing in Arabic culture. I inquired about what things he had learned. Of that new information that the army had given him, there was a key piece missing. It was the only piece of Arabic that I knew. Salam, I come with God's peace. When did we stop teaching peace? The army's supposed to be peacekeepers. They're not teaching peace. When did we stop? Teaching peace has to happen from the time we are born until the time that we die. The only way to stop terrorism is to teach peace, not to build bombs. The only way to teach peace is to teach our children to love their neighbor, all of their neighbors.
Vanessa German, Pittsburgh-based hip-hop artist, recently won an award for her poem, Thank You, George Mother Bush. We have an excerpt from her performance of it at Saturday's rally.
We the people, we realize that terror is not always guns and knives and otherwise explosive devices and surprises of evil. Sometimes terror is just making no living wage, going day to day, paycheck to paycheck, praying that nothing happens. Going day to day, paycheck to paycheck, praying that nothing happens to your kids because you can't afford broken arms, busted lips, or anything to do with teeth. Sometimes terror is just praying that your sons make it home. Not knowing which one of your beautiful black boys is gonna die, get shot while reaching back pocket for identification to prove that he's American, but not American enough to live free. Sometimes terror is just being 13 years old, having no access, no choice, and taking matters into your own hands. Sometimes terror is being a raped woman in the emergency room begging for contraception, emergency contraception, after your rights have been violated and forsaken before the eye of God, just like the Constitution after the 2000 election. George Bush, we all want to thank you. We want to thank you from the bottom of our soul for showing us that justice is actually ours. It has to be exercised with every single breath that we take. It is our responsibility to be American and to hold you accountable for the deaths.
The final speaker of the rally was Tim Vining of the Thomas Merton Center.
Real brief, where does the anti-war movement go from here? One thing I think is clear is imagine a world where we called a war and no one showed up to fight it.
Yes.
The power right now, how many of you in here are 30 or under? It is in your hands. You are the ones who have the power to stop this war by refusing to pick up arms, by laying down arms, or better yet, refusing to pick them up. You know you're being heavily recruited. And that's where the decision needs to be made. You are the front lines of this movement. I was in high school and college during the Reagan years, and we failed. My generation failed to build a youth and a student movement to stop that madman's agenda. And now you've been inflicted on an even madder man, George W. Bush. But the power is in your hands. The last 5 years, there's been a student movement. There's been a youth movement. It's growing. You're in leadership. And the day you step up and tell the rest of us, I'm over 30. When you tell the rest of us, whether we want to hear it or not, hell no, we won't go. I deserve a job and an education without having to kill someone in order to get it. Your priorities are fucked up. Your morality is really off base. As much as you preach morality, it's really fucked up. And you, but the good news is, you have the power to say no, to stop this war, to get on every community college campus that's heavily recruiting for the military, and to say, if you can't keep them out, look them in the eye, say you're lying to us, like the, you lied about weapons of mass destruction, you're lying about jobs, you're lying about money for education, you want to use this as cannon fodder, and hell no, we won't go.
That was Tim Vani of the Thomas Merton Center at Saturday's anti-war rally. We're going to take a brief musical break, and we'll be right back.
Was Pittsburgh's anti-war marching band that needs a name. This week, we will introduce a new segment of Respawn Radio, a highlight of a local grassroots organization. On today's show, we'll have an interview with Prevention Point Pittsburgh, a group that runs a needle exchange program and overdose prevention education services. The first exchange program in Pittsburgh began in 1995 when two AIDS activists set up a sterile needle program in the Hill District. In 1998, after pressure from an anonymous individual, the police officially closed down the needle exchange. But 3 years later, the Allegheny County Board of Health declared the high levels of HIV and hepatitis C infection among intravenous drug users a public health emergency, allowing Prevention Point to become a center for legalized needle exchange in Allegheny County. Rust Belt spoke with Renee Cox, the executive director of Prevention Point, and also with Alice Bell, the overdose project prevention coordinator.
The purpose of needle exchange is to reduce transmission rates of HIV and hepatitis C and other bloodborne diseases associated with injection drug use. We operate under basic principles of infectious disease control as well as a harm reduction philosophy, which is an idea that no individual or group should be stigmatized or marginalized in a way that places them outside of the reach of healthcare, and that every individual has the right to the health tools and information to protect themselves and their families. The aim of harm reduction programs is to reduce the negative consequences of drug use both to the user in the community, and needle exchange programs are a classic example of harm reduction. And the reason the needle exchange programs have got started is because injection drug use is a major source of transmission of bloodborne disease. Pennsylvania, contaminated needle sharing is the leading mode of transmission of HIV. And in addition to HIV/AIDS, injection drug users are the largest single risk group for hepatitis C.
Now, Renee talked a little bit about the philosophy of harm reduction, which overdose prevention is another example in addition to needle exchange of harm reduction. In Allegheny County, the rate of overdose deaths has quadrupled in the past 20 years. In the 1980s, there were an average of 58 overdose deaths a year. In 2003, there were 229 drug overdose fatalities. And that's actually more than the combined total of deaths from traffic accidents and homicides put together. And that's been the case for the past several years. This is an example. The attention that's been paid to this increase in overdose deaths in a lot of the media and community forums and that sort of thing, has really focused on how to stop people from using drugs. And, of course, eliminating drug use reduces a lot of health risks, reduces the risk of HIV, hepatitis C, overdose death. But what we find is that the fact is that there are a lot of people who use drugs for lots of different reasons. And harm reduction takes the approach that rather than waiting to figure out how to create a society where nobody is using drugs, that we need to take actions to reduce drug-related harms in the meantime or as life goes on. So overdose deaths are really almost entirely preventable. Opiate overdose deaths are reversible through the use of naloxone, which is usually known as Narcan, that paramedics carry. In Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh City Emergency Medical Services, they respond to 2 to 3 overdose calls a day, and they administered Narcan about 600 times last year. So they save a lot of people's lives, but 229 deaths is a huge number.
Do you think the government's approach to drug use is similar to their approach of sex and encouraging abstinence-only programs?
Sure. I mean, when we talk to people in the community about needle exchange or overdose prevention or harm reduction, most people really get the basic principle. It makes a lot of sense to them that people who, just because somebody uses drugs, it doesn't make sense that they should die. people use drugs for a lot of different reasons, and they stop using in a lot of different ways for a lot of different reasons. And if they're dead, then they don't get to make those choices. And that makes a lot of sense to most people. Certainly on a national level, the federal government, the Surgeon Generals for years and years going back have said that needle exchange is effective, doesn't increase drug use. Surgeon Generals going back to, I think, maybe 1997 or 98 mm-hmm. have been supportive of needle exchange. And still there's a federal ban on any funding for needle exchange in spite of that. And that's really a political issue. That
in terms of restrictions then that Alice was mentioning, in addition to the federal ban on funding going to needle exchange programs, Pennsylvania also has a ban on state funding going to needle exchange programs. Pennsylvania is actually lagging behind in terms of sterile syringe access. They're one of the 4 states left that still requires someone to have a prescription to buy syringes at a pharmacy. They also have the paraphernalia law, and then they have the ban on state funding. We're part of a statewide effort to have some of these restrictions lifted, but you know, it's been a slow process. And even though harm reduction programs are gaining more acceptance, they still remain underfunded. We struggle with funding since day one.
Do you think that the needle exchange program helps with rehabilitation and other by providing access to other services?
Yeah. Historically, injection drug users have been a marginalized, very hard-to-reach population. What needle exchange programs do, outside of just providing basic prevention services, they draw this population in and are able to serve as a bridge to other social services that they may need. Our case manager, Becky Altman, she spends a large portion of her time trying to secure treatment beds for people. But the problem is that there's a lot of obstacles and there's a lot of barriers to gaining access to treatment. There's waiting lists. There's people without insurance. People throw treatment as sort of like a panacea for all the problems, but in reality, it's actually not that easy to obtain.
I have a really good story about as how needle exchange kind of can work for people. Is from Philadelphia and actually was involved in the Philadelphia Needle Exchange, who told me his story. And he said that he started out going to the Needle Exchange program in Philadelphia many years ago because he was able to get new syringes. And new syringes are a lot easier and more comfortable for people to use than reusing old ones. This person said he started going to the Needle Exchange because he got access to new sterile syringes. And he was at that point had been using heroin for years. The way that he described himself, he said that he was in very bad shape, and he was sure that he had HIV. He'd shared needles many times, and he was convinced that he had HIV, but he went to the needle exchange not so much for disease prevention, but just because there were new sharp needles. And in going there, he talked to the volunteers there, and over time somebody said to him, well, you know, if you know that you have HIV, what does it hurt to get tested? And eventually he decided to get tested, and he found out he was negative. And he said that up until that point, he'd felt like he sort of saw himself as most people, or as a lot of people often see drug users, that, you know, well, if you're addicted, you don't care about anything except your addiction. That's a common thing that people say. But he had a different attitude then. He thought, well, you know, if I don't have this disease, then I'm not going to get it. And so he said after that point, he never shared another syringe and never had unprotected sex. And he continued to use for several years after that. But it kind of changed the way he saw himself, that he felt like there were things he could do to take care of himself, even though he was using. And eventually he stopped using and is now a counselor in a drug treatment program. But I think that that is what I see at the needle exchange site, is that people who use the exchange are used to being told that they're hopeless until they stop using, that they won't do anything for themselves, and that people see, well, that's not really true. I can do things to take care of myself. And there's also no judgment placed on people. I know someone who...
If people think that these services are really important and would like to support Needle Exchange or help out in some way, what could they do?
One, they could make a donation to support our program. We're always struggling for money for sterile supplies. Another thing they could do is volunteer with the Needle Exchange. If they have a commitment to harm reduction, we can always use more volunteers for our program.
The Needle Exchange takes place in Oakland in the back of the health department at 3333 Forbes Avenue every Sunday from 12:30 to 2 p.m. If you would like to contact Prevention Point, you could call them at 412-247-3404. And for info about the exchange, you can call 491-0916. And their website is www.pppgh.org.
We go now to the Indie Media calendar of events. The weekly Thomas Merton Center video screening will be Incident at Oglala, about the American Indian movement on Pine Ridge Reservation, and the Leonard Peltier case. That's Tuesday at 6 p.m., 5125 Penn Avenue in Garfield.
The Pittsburgh Social Movements Forum presents Labor Movements in a Global Age, featuring lectures and a roundtable discussion. That's Thursday, March 24th at the University of Pittsburgh, Posfer Hall, room 2500.
This Friday is Critical Mass in Pittsburgh. You meet at the Oakland Dinosaur.
At 5:30. The Big Idea Info Shop will hold a new volunteer training at 11 a.m. on Sunday, March 27th. The bookstore is located on 504 Millvale Avenue near Liberty Avenue. More information on the Big Idea Info Shop can be found at thebigideapgh.org, or they can be reached at 412-OUR-HEAD, O-U-R-H-E-A-D.
This Sunday, March 27th at 8 p.m. at Kivahan at the center corner of Craig and Forbes is the Mountain Justice Summer meeting. You can come learn about his historic coalition between environmentalist radicals and coal communities to stop the devastation caused by coal mining in Appalachia. You can find out more about that by contacting Amy at 412-965-0943.
Thanks for tuning in to Rust Belt Radio here on WRCT Pittsburgh and WVJW Benwood. Our hosts this week were Quentin Steinhaus, Matt Toops, and Andalusia Knoll, with contributions from Abraham Flaxman. And this week's show was produced by Matt Toops and Abraham Flaxman. Special thanks to all of our hosts, producers, and contributors.
Your audio submissions are welcome. To get involved with Rust Belt Radio or to send us your comments, email radio@indypgh.org, or call us here at the station right now at 412-621-WRCT. All of our shows are available for download on our website at radio.indypgh.org.
Tune in next week at this time for another edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of the news overlooked by the corporate media.